Hey, everybody. JJJ, a.k.a. the Six Button Samurai, here once again with Game Agent E.T. And this is... Oh, God, it hurts.
Oh, God, it hurts.
Hey, buddy.
Welcome back, everybody. Episode 51. We've got a spate of fun topics to dive into today, not the least of which is the Fallout experience. There's a lot of hype around the franchise right now based on the Amazon streaming television series, which debuted its first season this month and has been unbelievably well received and has also resulted in a really tangible spike of interest for the franchise across the board. So we're going to dive into that. We're going to talk some localization as pertains to games like the recently released Eiyuden Chronicle 100 Heroes. And last but certainly not least, we're going to talk about the 35th anniversary of Game Boy, which Game Agent E.T. here is, of course, a lifelong diehard handheld man, as it were. So I know he's very eager to talk about that.
Oh, yes. Definitely. Gonna enjoy this episode.
Yeah. So, Eddie, what's going on? What are you playing right now? What's cracking?
Well, definitely still hammering away at Shadow of the Ninja. Getting a little bit further. It's a still pretty tough game. I am still not a fan of the gameplay, but I'm starting to get used to how the game is. So I'm starting to read a little bit more on how the enemies react and your limitations with the weapons, things like that. But,
okay.
Definitely, want to keep trying to beat the game, before the remake, which it finally has a date. August 29th is when it comes out. That's official.
I noticed that. I also saw some, I noticed a listing for the US version on Amazon.
Yeah.
And some slightly janky box art, which I don't know if that's like the same or if there's something better cracking in Japan as I would normally assume. But,
yeah, I heard that they have an artist that made the cover art for at least the Japanese version. And I heard that there were ties that this person had from the original. And that's why they came back to make the cover for the Japanese box art from what I saw. I don't know. I haven't seen the Western box art, but
it's not bad. It's just, I guess it's a little bit cartoonier than I would have expected.
Yeah, definitely. It's when you play the game, it has a little bit more of a, I wouldn't say realistic feel, but it's
a little more hard edge, though, like
more mature,
like something that would be aimed more at, like, you know, teenagers, young adults.
Yeah. So I don't know if that, you know how they, when they bring over a game, which is a good topic that we're going to go over today. But when they bring over a game and they change the look of certain characters to make it more Western looking or edgy looking. Right. I don't know if that happened with Shadow of the Ninja. I'd have to take a look at that because that'd be interesting if that was the case. But
well, it had a very, I recall the NES box and that was just like a very different looking thing. If I recall correctly, just kind of like your, you know, there was a lot of just sort of boilerplate, westernized, like vaguely the cover of a comic book sort of thing happening for NES box art way back in the day.
There's probably a total of five artists that they would have on speed dial, or they didn't have speed dial back then, but they would like call them up and say like, hey, you want to do a cover? Sure.
Is Rob Liefeld busy? Oh.
No, they would have tiny feet and humongous chests.
Lots of pouches.
Yeah. And the ability to look at a three-quarter chest at a side view, which is anatomically impossible. But I digress.
There is a joke on that that's in the Deadpool Wolverine trailer.
Oh, I saw that.
Where it's like Liefeld's just feet.
Yeah. It's the name of a shop that they had in the backdrop of one of the scenes. Hilarious, dude.
So,
he made a lot of bank, so he could laugh all the way towards it.
And I'm sure this is gonna net him quite a nice check, because there's a lot of hype around that particular movie as well.
Geez, that's the only superhero movie that's coming out this year, from what I understand. That's worth a damn, I should say. I should add. But yeah, it's kind of,
I don't know. It's interesting, and I think this actually segs sort of perfectly into our first primary topic, which of course is Fallout.
Yeah.
I know you're just beginning to get started watching the show, but that's perfectly okay. I have devoured the entire first season. My lady and I did, and we enjoyed it to pieces. And
yeah,
you know, the thing is, I recall Fallout back when it came out on the PC, like the first couple games that I know were isometric in nature.
Yeah.
And I had never played those. I made an attempt to play Fallout 3 on console, which that was the big game where they moved it to, you know, FPS.
Yeah.
And it didn't really pull me in, like, just by virtue of its gameplay, because I, you know, obviously anybody that listens to this show knows that I play a lot of JRPGs, and that's just generally my bag. So it wasn't a great fit for me, but at the same time, like, that franchise has just continued to grow and have a really active and at times excitable fan base. So, and, you know, also as somebody that grew up during the Cold War, like, you know, the themes of nuclear annihilation and, you know, this kind of creepy corporate layer to things are very near and dear to me. So even though the games themselves were certainly not the reason that I stopped to watch this, I was really floored by the quality of it. And, you know, my lady, pretty much same thing, and she didn't know anything about Fallout, but, you know, it's an impressive and well realized piece of TV. Can you describe your first impressions with it?
I was happy to see Kyle MacLachlan on it. I've become a big fan of his now because of that 2-month run I did a couple years ago watching Twin Peaks in its entirety.
You mainlined all the peaks.
Yes. And I was just floored by his performance. And of course, I've also seen him on Dune, the original Dune movie. So I was so happy to see him back on the screen. And I just was, just from beginning to end, I was just so focused on what's going to happen next. What's going to happen next is so good. And
yeah,
I was so tired because I went through a lot the past month and a half or so with work. So Golden Week is finally upon us here in Japan. Today is the first day of it. I'm taking 9 days off. So Fallout will definitely be on the plate for me to relax and enjoy, hopefully, as many episodes as I can. But I also don't know much about Fallout besides playing Fallout Shelter, which I don't know if you know this game, but this is a game that was made quite a while back for smartphones, and it ended up on Steam as well. It's like a resource management type of game. And it has a lot of the tongue-in-cheek humor that it has in the normal games, from what I understand. And I like it. I just need to play some of these games. So hopefully, maybe I'll ask around, see what games should I start off with. And hopefully my laptop will be able to run the older games. But
yeah, I mean, I was going to say there was an absolute flurry of different think pieces, either talking about the show or like, if you're a first time Fallout player, you should try this. So I would say if you flip through some of those articles, you're probably bound to find the answer to that query relatively quickly.
But what a way to advertise your game.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we've been in this period where video game to film or TV translations are finally not embarrassing.
Oh, most definitely.
You know, they're performing extraordinarily well, you know, between things like The Last of Us, the Sonic the Hedgehog movies, the Mario movie, you know, and it really sort of comes, I would say, at a perfect time, probably from Hollywood's viewpoint, because, you know, the superhero genre definitely feels like, you know, I know there's plenty of Marvel and DC stands that, you know, are still going to want and consume those things and enjoy them greatly. But I think in terms of like the wider audience, there's definitely some fatigue with superheroes writ large. So
I am unabashedly a Marvel fan, and I've seen pretty much every single thing that Marvel had to offer on the big screen and the small screen. The only thing I haven't seen was Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. And I still need to finish Echo. But other than that, I've seen pretty much every single thing. And yes, the fatigue is real.
Yeah.
But let's hope that video games don't end up having this fatigue period when it comes to movies, because that would be a shame. Well,
yeah. I mean, I was trying to think about, like, what is it specifically now with, like, this set of projects that is finally, you know, connecting with an audience and gaining some legitimacy for, you know, video games as an art form to be mined for these other forms of media. And I ran across this one article, and it was written by somebody named Jade King, and it was on thegamer.com. And this person's reasoning, by virtue of the headline, Fallout works because it isn't ashamed of being a video game.
And that, that is true. I mean,
well, I was trying to think of like some of the more notorious examples of things that like we grew up with that definitely were not successful. And of course, the real big ones that leapt to my mind are the original Super Mario Brothers movie with Bob Hoskins and John Leguizamo.
Yeah.
And of course, a movie that we watched when you were last here.
Yes.
Street Fighter, the movie.
But that movie was so bad it was good, but that's a little bit of outlier.
Which I'm definitely not of the mind that that was the intent with that particular thing.
No, definitely not.
And I would say, in terms of looking at that thesis statement, like, is the thing ashamed of being a video game? And I think with Street Fighter, it definitely was, because the folks that made that, you know, to a large extent, they pretty much just jettisoned everything story-wise that relates to Street Fighter itself, at least that which you can deduce just from playing the game. Like, it's not about these warriors all being in this giant tournament, you know, with Ryu being the main focus and a variety of other characters also having their own stories. You know, it was basically like, well, how do we turn this into like a G.I. Joe film?
Yeah.
And that's pretty much what happened with Street Fighter the movie.
Yeah, that was a classic tale of somebody probably not knowing the source and right. just going with, well, I see these characters as this. This is my mm-hmm. grand vision of how these characters could be. And mm-hmm. I think that's why nowadays you have generations of people who have played video games when they were young. Right. And they have played these games that they're making movie adaptations or miniseries adaptations for. And they know the sources pretty well. So mm-hmm. that's why they're much more well-informed. And they know how to make it so that they can make something like a story that feels like it's part of that universe, but at the same time, it can differentiate slightly so that mm-hmm. it doesn't feel like you're just playing, you're watching a video game movie and it's basically the same as if you played a video game of it. But it's like the Super Mario Brothers movie from the recent one, where right. they made enough subtle differences to make it feel like it's its own universe. But at the same time, they pay a lot of homage to what makes a series great. And they really played to the fans. Right. And I think that's really important if you want to make a good video game movie. People can right. easily tell.
If you contrast that with the 1993 Super Mario Brothers movie.
Yeah.
Very hard from most screenshots to tell that you were looking at something adapted from Super Mario Brothers.
Yeah. You could totally tell that it was more of a cash grab than anything. And
well, it was more like, okay, how do we take this wallpaper and wrap it around something that moviegoers will recognize?
Yeah.
And it just... Now, Super Mario Brothers is really kind of an extreme example. And if you spend any time poking around articles that exist about that film, development hell essentially redefined with the drive to make that movie. You know, I think Nintendo was still in its sort of early phase of like, well, how do we gauge the cultural outlook elsewhere? And how do we, you know, take these things that are successful for us in one medium and, you know, enlist the right help to bring those things to life? And I think with that film, it was clearly a case of they did not necessarily have the right people to do it. And also they didn't really have the right mindset about doing it because, again, like they were essentially trying to disguise the fact that what they were building a world on was based on this very sort of cartoony, bright, colorful thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to really make a spin out of Super Mario Brothers when you're very limited to the universe that it was in back in those times. And even now, it's not like Super Mario as a series really grew in terms of lore. Like, there's a lot of games, but I mean, storylines are not very deep in those games. It's more about gameplay and experiences yeah. than anything. But I think now you just have a lot of people that are very familiar with the characters and, like I said, have much more experience playing the game, so they can tell a tale that would be much more believable in terms of, yeah, that character would be like that, or yeah, this would happen.
Yeah.
It's much more, I mean, Super Mario Brothers is a great example of just being able to adapt to something that doesn't lend a lot in terms of storyline, but because of the amount of experiences you have with the games, and there are many, many games now, I mean, there's a huge well to kind of like play with. Whereas with Fallout, it's very impressive because of the fact that Fallout itself, along with other games like Last of Us, these are pretty much like big budget games that they've had a lot of script writing and a lot of stories and even spinoffs, right? Like I was talking about Fallout Shelter, things like that. Yeah. And with that, the lore's so big that it's a lot easier to make your own stories from that because you have a lot of things to kind of go back on in terms of, oh, they have this kind of character or this kind of scenario, so why don't we make this kind of scenario and grow from that? And not only that, just the budgets that they have for it and the amount of scenarios that are interesting. Like, geez, I would imagine the Grand Theft Auto or Red Dead Redemption movie would be next, right? For Rockstar, if they see that Fallout is doing so well.
See, that's a tough one, because I think about Grand Theft Auto, and I think part of the difficulty with that franchise, and again, a deeply subjective opinion that I'm tossing out here, the stories in GTA are for the most part kind of composites of stories that have been told in like other movies. You know what I mean? Like, it's a heavily cinematic thing, but that's because it references the shit out of crime movies, action movies, you name it. So, and that's such a like realistic world.
Yeah.
That I guess, like, how would you delineate, like, how would you make a GTA movie that specifically feels GTA and not like, oh, this is like someone's weird sequel to Heat? You know what I mean? Yeah,
that's true. But
I think with that franchise in particular, like, that's an interesting one because, again, it's something that's so steeped in the lore of other movies, and it's not really necessarily building a world of its own. But at the same time, given how insanely popular it is, I mean, maybe something like that, here's a form that it could exist in.
Yeah.
If there was like a Grand Theft Auto anthology series, and every season follows like one particular criminal.
Yeah.
Side stories. That could be like an interesting way of sort of threading that particular needle, because, and again, like, this is sort of the difference between like feature films and streaming television, is that like the feature film has to be composed of a series of events that are so big that it warrants that kind of runtime and expense. Like, there are some really big effing things that happen here, and they happen to happen in the parlance of a three-act structure executed somewhere between 100 and 140 minutes, go, kind of thing, right? Whereas, you know, streaming television as it exists today, infinitely more flexible, especially if you're going to crawl into the space of really telling some character-driven stories. I had this trick question lined up for you because I was curious, like, if you could wave a magic wand and have some video game property you love turned into a movie or a streaming TV show tomorrow, what would it be?
easily Red Dead Redemption.
Really?
That story is really good.
Nice.
I was very infatuated by that game because of the fact that I like Westerns, and the main character was such a good character. Storyline was very deep, very interesting, yeah, and a lot of action, a lot of suspense, and a lot of turns here and there. Mm-hmm. I'm surprised they didn't make a movie out of it. I've yet to play number two, but from what I've heard, it's definitely worth playing. And I'm looking forward to the day that I can play that game. It's going to be
awesome.
100-hour game, but I hope I'll have that sort of patience to play it. But yes, I would definitely love to see Red Dead Redemption in a movie, awesome, especially the first one. How about you?
Very cool. You know, for the longest time, and I'll say this counts because I first experienced it as a video game, even though I eventually came to learn that it also encompassed both and OVA series and a manga. I would love to see an adaptation, an episodic adaptation of Area 88.
Oh, yes.
Because I love that story so much. You know, being a dyed-in-the-wool Star Wars fan, I mean, I'm a sucker for anything with pilots. And that one is such a great and interesting, like, character story. And those OVAs are so bloody well done.
They are.
That, like, yeah, I would love to see that realized along those lines in some fashion. I think that would be really beautiful.
Yeah, I know it was called UN Squadron, like the video game that Capcom made that was based on Area 88. That's a classic game that you should play if you ever get your hands on it. It's one of those games that you're probably going to have to play in a certain way. Emulation. I saw that recently, like a few months ago. I found it on YouTube, the whole OVA series.
And, I was so bummed that I didn't turn you on to that sooner, because I caught that way back in the day. And it was only because Suncoast Video got Act One on VHS. It was put out by, I think it was a US Manga Corps production. And I was like, whoa, is this like what I think it is? Because it was titled Area 88 and not UN Squadron.
Yeah.
But I was like, no, man, that is Shin Kazama on the cover. That is definitely the thing that you think it is. And after that, I was just like, oh my God, I have to find the other cassettes or the comic books. I would love to see that weird little particular world realized. I think it would be awesome.
Yeah. Anyone that played UN Squadron, the story from Area 88 from the OVAs is so good. It's like it covers way more than the video game ever does. And the storyline is pretty gripping. So I highly recommend you watch it if you can.
Totally.
Great characters, great art. There's a recent, I don't know if it's OVA or not, but it was made for TV. I think it was made like in the 90s or something. That one's not so good. I think it's the 2000s, sorry, not 90s.
Yeah, I think it was like a mid 2000s thing, and it has that heavily CG look to it, whereas the classic Area 88 OVA series is just the most lush, hand-drawn. It's such a glorious example of all of that, you know, bubble economy Japanese cultural output, you know.
Classic, highly recommend it. But great for idea. Sure. I hope they do consider it someday, but I think it's now the time. because yeah, after that 2000 series, they need to kind of make up for that.
Yeah, definitely feels like it's game's time to shine. Speaking of shining, we're going to take a break right now, and we're going to turn the mics over to some of our cohorts here at the Ruminations Radio Network. We've got a galaxy shows for you to explore, enjoy, and discover. So check that out at ruminationsradionetwork.com. We'll be right back.
You've seen Twin Peaks all the way through, but all you have are spoiler-free discussions? At Blue Rose Task Force Podcast, no information is classified and nothing beats the listening sensation when production history collides with deep theory. Put the coffee on.
We're back.
Yes, I am circling my goblet of wine, waiting for you. And you finally came back. We are so glad. Let's keep it rolling.
Sure. So it's an interesting time as far as localizations. I definitely think that, like, you know, if your cup is JRPGs,
yeah,
there is a lot to play these days.
Great. It's a great situation to be in, but
yeah,
but.
So there's been a couple of games, and the ones that I'm thinking of are primarily Eiyuden Chronicle 100 Heroes, which dropped last week, Unicorn Overlord, which dropped earlier this year. A little bit of carbon going on. There's definitely some people that are not thrilled with the translation work done with these things. Eddie, what are some of your thoughts about this particular thing?
Well, to be honest, it's kind of hard to see all the harping because of the fact that I know quite a few localization editors and people that are in the field that do work, localization work, and it's not an easy job. Mm-hmm. And the fact that people are now sniping online about their works, and on top of that, the threat of AI possibly taking their jobs. You know, there are some companies that are leaning towards AI translations instead of hiring a localization editor. It's just not a fun thing to be a part of anymore right now in terms of job security and just in general, like with the added scrutiny from online pundits. It's harder to stay afloat than. It's not like something that's so glamorous that you could live your life off this sort of job occupation, but it's tough. I mean, I don't know.
I mean, it's definitely difficult. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we are talking about something that is just deeply subjective in nature.
It is,
you know, you know, having come up in the era when we missed more games than we got through the 16-bit eras, I think that's like the most safe generalization I can attach to that. Like, so many games.
Oh yeah,
did not show up here.
The tears I shed every time I saw a game on GameFan that I couldn't have. Because it was never going to come overseas.
Right.
Those days are long gone.
I mean, you know, we really had to sort of pick and choose and, you know, that was a whole time where, like, you got games like that and often there were spelling errors, there was funky punctuation, you know, a lot of it had to do with the incredibly technical nature of doing that. Like, it actually was more of a technical challenge than you might think, trying to cram like an English script, especially for a Japanese game with a lot of script going on.
Oh yeah.
Into that same size cartridge. So, you know, it was not strictly a matter of you know, attempt at taste making where, you know, the Western arm of a Japanese software developer would be looking at this thing and going, okay, like, how do we make this a little more palatable for folks here?
Yeah.
So you had technical hurdles, but also like with Nintendo themselves back in the day, they had a very fixed idea of what was appropriate content for their platforms. So a lot of times you would have Squaresoft making translation decisions or cuts to proposed localized scripts based on what they thought might run afoul of Nintendo's own guidelines for that kind of thing.
Yeah,
I don't know. What were you saying?
Oh, I remember you saying that some parts of Final Fantasy VI got changed because of, wasn't it religious references or death references, things like that?
You know, having just played the, I played the quote unquote uncensored Ted Woolsey script version of Final Fantasy VI.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think he makes a lot of really interesting and fun kind of graphic language. Like, you know, he's very intent on sort of making it like, you know, this is a fantasy epic and there are like lives at stake and genuine villains. And so, you know, he was trying to eke the most out of that text as far as like, you know, giving it a really strong sort of memorable flavor. And I think, you know, those above him at Square and Nintendo were just like, they weren't always comfortable with a variety of those choices. And like, you know, some of it had to do with like, you know, there would be like a little sort of fairy sprite whose booty would be visible. And then they'd like draw clothes over it, which is the kind of thing you saw in like a variety of games at that time, sort of before the ESRB rating system had really taken root.
Yeah.
You know, for the most part, it was just like Nintendo and Sega sort of policing their own herd for that stuff. So I don't know. I mean, I, having been a player during that period and just seeing how many things we completely missed out on, like, I wish more modern players knew like just how good they have it in that realm these days, because there's definitely so many of those games that would have once just been considered, oh, that's a niche game, like that'll never sell a million copies, why even bother,
or that's too Japanese oriented, no one's gonna understand it.
And I mean, the fact that so often now, like, you know, if a game doesn't come with English and Japanese like voiceovers in tow, they'll wind up tossing that out as a free piece of DLC later on. You know, I think they've been really, for the most part, like that is, you know, it has never been a better time to be a fan of those kinds of games, because you've never had as much to play in your life.
So definitely they should be more great. Oh, I wouldn't say grateful, but just in general, thankful.
Well, the thing is, like, from my standpoint, like, if your Japanese is good enough that you are looking at a translation of something and you have the original to compare it to, and you prefer the original, good Lord, man, just play the original. Like,
yeah. I agree.
You know, I would argue that like the person that is in that rarefied percentage of someone that is able to fluently enjoy both versions of a game like that, that's not really who the localizations are for.
Yeah. I mean,
you know,
I mean, if you want to make a difference, why don't you join the force and actually do localization for these companies and make the difference that you want to make instead of just sitting behind a screen and nitpicking and just bashing these companies when they're trying their damnedest to bring out this content that some companies are always saying, like, well, I don't know. I don't know if it would do good in North America or in Europe. I don't know. But no, a lot of people, including localization teams, try to make their pitch to say, like, no, we can make it so that people will see how good of a game it is and we'll do the best we can to make it an enjoyable game in English. And I think another thing a lot of people fail to see or understand is that localization is not the same as translation. Sometimes translation, sometimes you don't want that because sometimes the actual characters in the game or the actual script is not as exciting as you would hope it is. Or sometimes there are some content that just doesn't really fit well with other cultures. Like, case in point, I was mentioning there are some things in Japanese culture that they put in some RPGs or other games, but a Westerner would not understand at all what's going on. So you would have to change it to make it something that is more relatable. And that's what a localization editor does. I mean, makes it more relatable to the culture that they're bringing the game out to. So it's not supposed to be a literal translation. If you want a literal translation, just you have your phone and there's enough technology to use Google Translate by pointing your phone at a screen and translating it directly if that's what you want. But I don't know. I prefer the localization because I rather not go through all that trouble. And not only that, they do pretty good jobs of bringing the content where it's not too far off from the source material. No one's perfect, but then again, it's like, do you really want to be perfect? I think
we're definitely past, like, you know, a vintage example of this would be Working Designs and a lot of their efforts during the 16 and 32-bit era, where they took some pretty large liberties with the source material and injected just a whole lot of their brand of humor and a ton of, like, you know, Western media cultural references and that kind of thing. And it was, some folks were just really stoked to get those games. Other folks sort of knew that, like, there were some questionable choices being made. And I think the people doing it now are far more sensitive about that kind of thing and are just trying to deliver something that is as evocative of the original as possible while still being, you know, balancing that with accessibility for, you know, your ideal curious Western gamer that maybe doesn't have a handle on all of that sort of Japanese cultural subtlety and can just enjoy the game without, you know, an added set of references. And so
if you can play the game and have fun without noticing, like, something feels out of place, I think you did a great job as a localization editor. I think that's the whole point, just to make the game for that subset of groups that you're releasing to, countries, and just make it so that it doesn't feel out of place. And you just want that. I mean, the people who nitpick, there's such a tiny amount of people that make up that audience compared to the general audience that just want to play the game. It's not worth, you know, just
catering to those people. It's the blessing and the curse of social media in that, you know, you can draw attention to obvious problems with any given thing that need like a fix as soon as possible, but then
yeah,
you can also complain infinitely about things that maybe don't warrant that much griping.
Yeah, I mean, I can speak a fair amount of Japanese. I know a fair amount of Japanese. And when I play some role-playing games, I'll notice differences. But at the same time, I'm not saying like, oh, that's definitely not what they said. That it, they missed the nuance completely. You know, I'm not going to nitpick because right. they got the general idea. And mm-hmm. I think it's a blessing to be able to do, to be able to understand both, to be honest. You get two yeah. sides of everything. And I don't know, like with that situation, if you're really curious about what they're really saying, I think it'd be great because then you probably want to study Japanese and kind of do your own research. And that's great in its own right. I don't see why it's worth complaining. I think it's worth celebrating. I like it.
Yep.
Totally. Just my opinion, but complaining about nothing, what to do about nothing.
It's true. So I was going to say, last but certainly not least on our little laundry list of topics to address this week.
Yes.
The Game Boy turns 35.
Happy birthday.
Yeah.
No longer a boy. It's a full grown man
it's a middle aged man now. You know, beginning to worry about his hair.
Yeah.
Or fading
scan lines.
green and gray dot matrix screens.
Oh man. You missed out if you didn't have an original DMG 001.
Did you own one?
I did. Well, my brother did. I always played off his Game Boy.
Nice.
I played it more than he did.
Yeah.
Even though he didn't want me to, but.
What did you play the most of?
Well, I definitely played a lot of Super Mario Land. There was this game I remember called Mercenary Force. Do you remember that game?
I don't.
That game, it's a little hazy now at my old age, but it was a game where you hire like certain amounts of like fighters, and it takes place in medieval Japan, and it's kind of like a shooter, but you can change the formation of your four types of fighters, and I believe you can choose between ninjas, monks, shoguns, whatnot. And it was a pretty cool game. It was very underrated. I don't think many people knew about it, but I played a lot of that game. So if you...
Oh, it sounds pretty cool.
Yeah. If you have a chance, play it. What about you? What comes into your mind when you hear Game Boy?
You know, I had a very on and off relationship with Game Boy. I had read about it in Electronic Gaming Monthly, and I was excited for it.
Uh-huh.
That green and gray screen.
Yeah.
It was not fun to play on.
It was not. I tolerated
it. And it's, yeah. I think everybody tolerated it. And if you peruse through the pages of a game magazine from that era,
yeah,
like there were so many different piece of shit accessories designed to somehow alleviate the pain of staring directly at a DMG screen,
yeah,
and having enough light, like so many different lighting solutions or magnifiers. I mean, I can just imagine the ocean of rotting plastic that thing generated just by virtue of janky accessories that allowed people to play that thing with marginally more clarity.
Yeah, I remember the,
it's,
The big one. Do you remember the big one that you pretty much made it like three times the size after you put everything on, but it gave you a magnifying glass, bigger speakers, bigger.
And it had like a stupid like joystick and button overlay yes. thing.
Yeah. I forgot the name of that thing, but it was all over the game magazines. I was like, who would want that?
No, there was all kinds of crap like that that came out the first few years, you know, trying to address the shortcomings of that system. So, like, I bought one right when it came out because I was so curious about it. Like, the idea that there would be a handheld that would have games on cartridges just like a regular console was pretty mind-blowing at the time, just conceptually. And it's hard to remind people that, like, yeah, that was not always a given. And I just think about, like, the unbelievable fortune that Nintendo had in securing the console rights for Tetris.
Oh, yeah.
And having that game as the original pack-in here in North America, because that game was really like the perfect, like the killer app that allowed Game Boy to, you know, for a player to get sort of the best experience possible early on, given developers' unfamiliarity with the hardware. Like, that game was really it. Like, it was really the perfect thing to bundle with it and have people, at least with that one game, really feeling like, oh, like, this is a cool little machine. You know, I think I wound up in my first ownership of Game Boy having maybe like four games total. You know, I know I had the Tetris pack in. I had Super Mario Land. I had Alleyway. And I think I also wound up with the Castlevania Adventure.
Oh, yeah. Which wasn't so good.
That's putting it lightly, Ed.
It was terrible. It was.
So, yeah. As fortune has it, like, I just received a copy of this book called Legends of 16-Bit Game Development.
Uh-huh.
And it's a history of treasure and the Sega Mega Drive. Written by John Harrison. The book begins by focusing on the journey of Masato Maegawa, the founder of Treasure. And he talks about joining Konami in 1989, and, you know, internally, like, the guys that were put on the Castlevania Adventure, which was their first offering for Game Boy, they were all just kind of like, oh, man, we really drew the short straw, like, happened to make this game. It's like, they looked on the console with a fair amount of skepticism, like how successful is this going to be given that screen and the difficulties with visibility and, you know, what was even, you know, there'd already been a long period of time by that point where, you know, the NES had limitations, and so many on that staff had plowed into that stuff. And, you know, they used all the tricks that were available, all the different sorts of add-on chips that were available for NES carts. And, like, you know, the knowledge pool was deep for that thing. And then to suddenly be flung into making games for this new thing that was even more limited by virtue of having, you know, four shades of gray on the screen. So to me, like, it's really, really funny that, like, the story of Treasure begins with, you know, that guy being a newbie at Konami and them absolutely struggling to try to put together this game that is even like a reasonable facsimile of what the Castlevania experience would be like on a console.
Well, to at least give it credit, the second game you should not miss, Belmont's Revenge. Yeah. It's actually really, really good and probably one of the best games you could play on Game Boy.
Okay.
Because they fixed a lot of the things that plagued the first game. It's a lot more fun to play. The music is phenomenal. And I would highly recommend that game if you ever get a chance to play it.
The first one is that, like, there's some good tunes in tow. Like, some of the music's pretty good, especially, like, utilizing that Game Boy sound hardware, which became, like, you know, to this day, it's still kind of a dark horse favorite among chiptune enthusiasts, right?
Well, most definitely. People play chiptune DJ stuff from a Game Boy at live sets. So, yes, it's
totally
definitely fan favorite for the hardware.
But, yeah, that first game is so riding the struggle boat. Like,
yeah,
I think of it like purely in design terms, like in the first couple levels.
Yeah,
there are little, you know, crosses that turn you temporarily invincible.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're looking at like the physical positioning of your character and when the enemies come out and how slow your movement is, those little invincibility items are there because the developers know you can't get out of the way of those things coming your way.
I would call that clever design. I don't know what you're talking about. That's brilliant. They should be championed. That should be put on the resume. I made this terrible part of this game actually playable.
Yeah.
Hire me. But I digress.
So at any rate, you know, that sidebar with that book, like,
yeah,
I'm really looking forward to reading more about that. And, you know, I think it's super fascinating that, you know, this group of expatriates from Konami, you know, really sought to lean into the Mega Drive hardware and just become like absolute masters of it. Like being able to make that thing do tricks that should otherwise have not have been possible, like things that other developers were just not capable of.
I want to get that book too. Maybe in a future episode, we'll talk about it. If I get it too, we'll share our thoughts on John Harrison's book. Probably good to recommend. I would think John Harrison's a good guy. I believe he's from Digital Foundry, right?
That I don't know.
I'm not sure.
Yeah,
I thought he was. But
are you thinking of John Linneman?
Yeah, I'm sorry, not John Harrison.
Different dude. It's all right.
Sorry, but
I'm sure they both have the exact same outlook about Treasure. So
yeah, but
no offense, none taken. But
Game Boy though, last thing. Not only was it great because of the fact that it was a follow up to Game and Watch, which I love the pieces. It felt great to have interchangeable cartridges in a handheld that it could hold. Limitations would be damned.
Yeah.
But some of those just box art covers of not only the system with the metallic hands and the cool logo where it shows like an original Game Boy and it shows like if it's one player, it's like some dude side view with the headphones on.
Yeah, the little, icons. Yeah.
And the little grid in the background, totally 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And then like a lot of the box art for classic games, like Quick Alleyway with little Mario in that little spaceship that's, you know, like the Vals from Arkanoid from Taito. It's just right. great to see all that art. It made me so excited to not only play the games, but anticipate the games every time I saw a new ad.
Yeah.
In the video game magazines. And yeah, it's just all that nostalgia keeps coming to me every time I see that in my old age.
But yeah, I mean, a lot of my choices in that time, like I was not a rich kid by any means whatsoever. So
nor was I.
If I decided that like I wanted a new piece of game hardware, generally that meant, oh, I need to get rid of an existing game piece of hardware I have. So like, you know, I was very eager to embrace some of the other rivals that arrived to challenge Game Boy's place in the market. You know, I wound up owning a Game Gear.
Neo Geo Pocket Color, too.
That was definitely much later down the pipe. But I mean, owned a Game Gear, owned an Atari Lynx, which also had some really cool games and had a screen that was definitely light years ahead of the others. But like they all had issues in that time. I mean,
yeah, the ghosting.
Link definitely had an uneven flow of games that came for it. And, you know, it wouldn't have a presence in the market for too long. Game Gear had kind of a strangely blurry sort of screen, despite the fact it was backlit and color. Also, my God, like the Game Gear would absolutely destroy 6 AA batteries in about 35-40 minutes. And that was just way too expensive to deal with.
Yeah. That's like Nomad. Oh my God. Mm-hmm. Nomad. All I did was I always plugged that in. I never used batteries on that thing. But that thing was like one of the best handhelds in its time.
Yeah.
It was amazing. Yeah. But I think overall, the Game Boy experience was great. The game I recommend the most, you have to play it. It's obviously Link's Awakening.
Yeah.
Still one of the most underrated games.
See, and that was Zelda. The interesting thing about it was that, you know, it was clear early on that, like, one-to-one ports of popular NES games would not be possible, especially early on in the Game Boy's life. Like, you know, you compare Super Mario Brothers to Super Mario Land, and you know, it's clear what a very different experience those things had to be, depending on what they were on. But then later on, like, you know, you had bank switching possibilities, and that's what enabled Super Mario Land 2 6 golden coins to look far more like the SNES game, crazily enough.
Yeah. Another good game.
And so yeah, that hardware really sort of improved and evolved by leaps and bounds, and you know, wound up lasting almost 12 years on the market, you know, including the 1998 release of Game Boy Color, which, you know, you could even argue that that was a bit of a forerunner for the mid-generation hardware refresh, right?
Yeah, like the PS5 Pro and things like that. And it was a great jump, because adding color and a more visible screen and better battery life, that was more than welcome for everyone.
Yeah.
And the big backlog of the library of games that are already on it, along with color Game Boy games that were specially made for the color Game Boy. It's just great. Yeah. It was a good time to enjoy that handheld for as long as you could. But
so, I mean, now I'm experiencing a lot of those games on Mister, and I mean, it's really, it's impressive just how much more they were able to do given some time and added familiarity with the hardware. I mean, you know, suffering through that first Castlevania game, and then Nemesis, which was the first like like Game Boy version of Gradius that it was a little better and a little more promising as far as like, oh, you know, they could do some more consistent like adaptation work for some of those console games over to the Game Boy. But
yeah,
it wound up really coming a long way for everybody that was faithful to that platform. So
yeah, a lot of great games. You should try some of them if you ever get the chance, even if it's not on a portable system. Just try it out. Have fun.
Yep.
And
there's many ways to experience that in 2024.
Most definitely. But happy birthday, Game Boy.
Yeah.
You're always going to be in my heart for sure.
It should also be known, it was a known thing at the time that Sony engineers, when they got a hold of the Game Boy, obviously the Walkman played a very specific part in like the overall like physical form factor of the Game Boy.
Yeah.
Much like, oh, this should have been a Sony product.
It could have been.
Yeah.
I think that probably Field of Fire when, I think with the PlayStation, that rivalry kind of heated up with the whole, with the CD edition or the CD version that where Nintendo and Sony wanted to make a system together, right? And that fell through, and I'm sure, that's another story in itself.
Fall through, right? It was more like Nintendo knife into the back at CES announcing a previously unknown partnership with Philips.
Yeah.
To develop a CD peripheral, but
that's
another episode.
Yeah. But, they did make PSP and PS Vita.
They did.
Yeah. Those were great systems in its own right, but the pioneer Game Boy.
You are the single biggest handheld junkie I know, so if I was going to talk about the 35 years of Game Boy with anybody, it would be you.
Yeah, and I really want another Game Boy, but with the IPS screen so that I can actually see it with my aging eyes. I don't know if I can tell.
You got a lot of options now. I mean, there's even relatively cheap ones that are...
Yeah.
I think there's like a $90 kit now that's FPGA based. Mm-hmm. Oh. That just plays like Game Boy and Game Boy Color.
I will have to check that out.
Yeah.
But
like, if you don't feel like ponying up the whole knot for the analog pocket.
Yeah.
There's other options.
As much as I would like one of those. Yeah. It's a little steep. But yeah, one of these days I'll figure it out. But in the meantime, I got my Switch. I'm happy.
Yeah. So at any rate, we are out of time for this episode of Oh God, It Hurts. Oh God, It Hurts. I can talk. Anyway, this is episode 51. We hope you enjoyed it. Ed, is there anything you would like to share with the people before we're out?
Instagram and Blue Sky, Game Agent ET. That's where I'm at. How about you? Any new stuff?
You can find me on Instagram at Super Mario Kart, or you can also find us there at Oh God, It Hurts.
Yep. We're on Blue Sky, Twitter, and please follow us. We'll give you updates when we can.
Thanks again, as always, for listening in, and we will talk at you next time. Goodbye.